Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On this 4th of July, we'll revisit some of our most thought-provoking stories of those who were not free, even as America declared its independence on this day in 1776, such as Ona Judge, an enslaved woman owned by George Washington.
She sees black freedom around her. She also sees white men and women being paid a wage, and it affects her. It helps pull the trigger on her decision to free herself.
Also, it took more than 140 years after the Declaration of Independence for women to win the right to vote. We'll look back on the Bay State's role in women's suffrage.
Massachusetts really was a leader nationally in the women's suffrage movement, and the ideas spawned in Massachusetts affected the movement across the country.
Plus, LGBTQ soldiers in the Revolutionary Army. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy 4th of July to you. This day really celebrates an idea, the beginning of America's experiment with democracy. I mean, you know Thomas Jefferson's immortal words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But of course, in 1776, there were many in our nascent nation who did not enjoy equality, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness. There were many who simply were not free. So this hour, we want to revisit some of our best conversations that explore the stories of those who were not free, even as their nation declared its independence. And we'll begin with the story of Ona Judge. In 1796, a few years after the Constitution's ratification, in the waning days of George Washington's presidency, Washington and First Lady Martha Washington lived in the nation's capital, then Philadelphia. Washington's presidency would end the next year, and the first family were making plans to return to their Mount Vernon estate. Now, the Washingtons owned slaves, and they'd planned to return to Virginia with the slaves they held at the president's mansion. But 22-year-old Ona Judge didn't want to return to Virginia. She wanted her freedom. In May 1796, Judge escaped the Washingtons, seeking her own form of freedom on her terms. She found her way to New England and made a place for herself in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The Washingtons, though, pursued Judge. They never captured her. However, it wasn't for want of trying. In the waning days of his presidency, Washington used the force of the federal government to return Ona Judge to slavery. He failed. And he continued to pursue Judge unsuccessfully all the way until his death. Well, Erica Armstrong Dunbar is a professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware, and she tells the story of Judge in her new book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. And when Dunbar joined us back in 2017, we began with the question of who Ona Judge really was.
Ona was one of hundreds of enslaved people who were born or brought to Mount Vernon. Important to note is that she was technically the property of Martha Washington. Mm-hmm. She had been passed down, or rather her mother had come from Martha Washington's first husband's estate. Martha Washington came to Mount Vernon, brought Ona's mother, Betty, with her. And Betty would go on to have some kind of encounter or relationship with a white indentured servant named Andrew Judge. And Ona was born at Mount Vernon at the age of 10. She went up to the mansion house to serve Martha Washington and sort of moves up in the ranks and becomes basically Martha Washington's top slave. Mm. Mm. And she would also sort of take on the responsibilities of being a seamstress and a spinner, but she would do the most kind of intimate chores, helping Martha Washington bathe, brush her hair, fix her clothing. She knew her mistress well.
Yeah. Well, in 1789, after George Washington becomes president, the first president, you write in your book that Martha actually reluctantly joins him in the then first capital, which was New York. We're changing capitals a lot here in the early days of the country. What was that reluctance all about?
She referred to her days in the North, actually, as the lost days. She shared her husband with the nation for years during the American Revolution, and she worried about George Washington's health, and she didn't want to leave Virginia. She wanted to stay, and so she had no kind of control over her ability to stay. And so Washington actually goes to his own inauguration alone.
Huh. Well, I guess maybe what I should have asked more specifically is, given that they were slave owners, both in New York, but maybe especially in Philadelphia, things are complicated regarding like Philadelphia as a city and slavery. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there were differences clearly between New York and Philadelphia. Yeah. And I think the Washingtons really kind of run into a roadblock with slavery when they come to Philadelphia. The nation's capital moves again in 1790. And the Washingtons take 9 enslaved people with them to Philly. And the laws of Pennsylvania say that you can't hold an enslaved person there. If you're a non-resident, you can't bring your slaves with you for longer than 6 months. And if you do, they have the opportunity to find freedom. So George and Martha and their secretary, Tobias Lear, purposefully rotate their slaves in and out of Pennsylvania. They write to each other that they want to keep it discreet. So he's not actually breaking the law, but he's definitely breaking the spirit of the law. So he would rotate Ona Judge and her other enslaved companions every 6 months back to Virginia or to New Jersey if a trip to Virginia was too difficult.
Now, when Ona was in Philly, did she see? Do we know if she saw firsthand? There were free blacks living in the city at the time.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia was the epicenter for black freedom and had more free blacks than anywhere else. Yeah, she saw it on the streets. She saw black entrepreneurs. She saw Richard Allen building Mother Bethel Church around the corner. There was no way to keep her from that. She saw it.
I mean, I cannot imagine I don't even know what to call it, the internal conflict, crisis, sense of what do you call it when you know you are being kept an enslaved person and you see the possibility of your liberation just right there on the street every day when you leave the house with the person who's your owner.
Yeah, I think that it shows the complexity of slavery, right? It's that Ona Judge would live 7 years in the North and really came of age at this moment from the age of 16 to really 22 or so. And she sees black freedom around her. She also sees white men and women being paid a wage. So there's a wage labor system that's now in place. And it affects her and it helps pull the trigger on her decision to free herself, or at least to steal herself from the Washingtons.
Wow. And so when and how did she decide then to pursue her freedom?
She finds out that she's going to be given away. She's going to be given away as a wedding gift to Martha Washington's granddaughter, a woman who was about the same age and who was known for having a kind of volcanic temper. And that decision, that change in her ownership, in addition to her experiences in a free North, made Ona make the decision, I just cannot stomach my enslavement anymore. And she turns to a free black community in Philadelphia for help.
Yeah. Wow. And how does she make her way to Portsmouth then?
Yeah. So she, luckily for us, Ona leaves behind 2 interviews at the end of her life. And she tells us in these interviews that it's the free black community of Philadelphia that helps plan her trip. She says while the Washingtons were packing their things to go on their summer trip, she was packing her things to go too. She didn't know where. But eventually the free black community would help her. She doesn't give names because it's a federal crime to help or aid a fugitive slave. The only name she gives us is the name of the ship captain, John Bowles, who I was able to trace his ship into the port of Philadelphia in May of 1796. She gives us his name in her interview because he's deceased. She tells us that they were the ones, that it's the free black community and John Bowles who ferries her to freedom or a semblance of freedom in Portsmouth.
Hmm. There's so much more I want to cover with you, and we're fast running out of time. I'm getting greedy now. But, you know, it's easy to at a distance to try to paint a life of in freedom as one of a grand transformation of that's so much better. And, of course, by definition, it has to be better because she was no longer enslaved. But was her life any easier in Portsmouth?
Yeah, I think it's actually, a decision not to use the term free or freedom in the title of the book. The book is called Never Caught for a reason, because Ona was actually never free.
Okay.
And what the book does is dismantle this myth about what freedom in the North supposedly was. Ona would live for half of a century as a fugitive, constantly looking over her shoulder and really forced to live a life of poverty and great hardship. But she says in her interviews, she would do it all again, that it was worth it, that the material goods meant nothing.
So tell me more about this, you know, half a century living as a fugitive. And for much of that time, or part of that time at least, I mean, it's the president of the United States who's using all that's at his disposal in terms of the power of the federal government to chase her.
Yeah, he turns to the Secretary of the Treasury. He turns to customs collectors in Portsmouth. And all of this, by the way, is documented by Washington's own hand. So this is me using his words.
And so what does he say?
He says, go get her. He says, you know, my wife is very desirous of seeing her again. And I'd like you, we're going to do this under the most discreet, quiet manner possible. Go get her, and for as little cost as possible as well. And what's so interesting here is that it's a moment where George Washington clearly does break the law. He breaks the fugitive slave law, which set into action a process, a procedure in returning the enslaved who were fugitives. Lawyers and magistrates were to be involved, and Washington wanted none of that.
Hmm. And this is a pursuit that he maintained until he died.
Pretty much. He dies unexpectedly in December of 1799. We have correspondence that says up until September, he's still pursuing her.
So, but did his death then proffer Ona true freedom?
No, it doesn't, because the thing to remember is that Ona was actually the property of Martha Washington.
Yeah.
And while we know that George Washington emancipates his slaves in his will following the death of Martha, Martha sets no one free. So none of the property passed down from her first husband to her grandchildren or anyone she bought outright was ever free. So while Ona would have known that the president had died, she also knew that it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It did not set her free. And so even though we have not come across accounts of people going after her, she lived with the understanding that she was someone else's property, and any children that she had were also fugitives.
Wow. Wait just a couple seconds. Can you just give us, like, what's one of the lessons that you draw from Ona's life?
Strength and resistance, you know, for her, it brought her something close to freedom, and she never regretted it.
Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar is a professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware. She's also author of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for joining us on this special 4th of July edition of the show. We're listening back to our favorite conversations about those who were not free, even as America declared its independence. When Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of, quote, governments that are instituted among men, he and the founding fathers meant literally that, men, not men and women, just men. Abigail Adams wouldn't have it. In March 1776, the Continental Congress met in Philadelphia. Abigail Adams wrote a remarkable letter to her husband, John Adams. She wrote, quote, I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Abigail Adams went on. She wrote, do not put such unlimited power into the hands of husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. A few weeks later, John replied. He wrote in a letter, quote, "We know better than to repeal our masculine systems. To give this up would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat." Well, it took 144 years before the nation would remember the ladies. Women finally won the right to vote in 1920. Historian Barbara Berenson argues that while the Women's Declaration of Independence was first drafted in Seneca Falls in 1848, it was at the Worcester Women's Rights Convention in 1850 where the suffragette movement truly gathered steam. Berenson says that while history remembers Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Susan B. Anthony, it would also do well to remember Massachusetts women Lucy Stone and the Grimke sisters. Berenson's book is called Massachusetts in the Women's Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers, and she joined us back in May of this year and started by telling us more about the Grimke sisters circa 1837.
Angelina and Sarah Grimke were two extraordinary women from Charleston, South Carolina. They were the white daughters of a wealthy slave-owning family, and they left Charleston, went to Philadelphia, and became involved in the abolitionist movement, which at that point was a very new movement. 1831 was the beginning of the newspaper The Liberator, published in Boston. And Angelina and Sarah became such passionate abolitionists that they were trained to be anti-slavery agents to go out and speak against slavery and were sent on a tour throughout Massachusetts in the summer of 1837.
Okay, so they were advocating for abolition, though. How did that then lead them to pushing for suffrage?
Well, that is the perfect question. What happened was it was really not accepted in that era that women would speak out on political issues at all, and certainly, above all, not accepted that women would speak to audiences of men and women about political issues. But that's precisely what Angelina and Sarah Grimke did. They spoke to audiences of men and women throughout Massachusetts. And leaders in Massachusetts, including particularly Congregational church leaders, tried to shut them down and said that what they were doing was unacceptable and, in fact, would bring degeneracy and ruin upon society.
They resisted,
they refuted, and they fought back.
I love how you wrote that they were criticizing, this is such wonderful 19th century language, from departing from a woman's sphere.
Correct.
Yeah, but you quote Angelina Grimke as writing, "I contend that woman has just as much right to sit in solemn council in conventions, conferences, associations, and general assemblies as men, just as much right to sit in the presidential chair of the United States."
Correct. So in 1837, when they were told to sit down and shut up, they did not. They continued speaking, and they wrote a powerful series of letters defending a woman's rights to speak out on political issues, including making statements such as the one you just read. And that, I argue in my book, is really the start of the women's rights movement.
I want to ask you, Barbara, I'm still taken by the fact that the Grimke sisters, for example, felt a sense of their own political empowerment because of the abolitionist movement. I mean, that seems to be kind of central to the emergence of pro-suffrage activity in Massachusetts because the state was such a hotbed of abolition. Could you see the two happening independently of each other, or are they inextricably intertwined?
I think personally that they are inextricably intertwined. The women's rights movement emerged directly from within the abolitionist movement, and it was the leaders of the abolitionist movement, such as William Lloyd Garrison, who welcomed women to be full participants in the movement, which was an incredibly radical position.
Fully enfranchised women? Well, did he welcome that? Or
yes, Garrison did. I mean, Garrison was at the very radical end of the abolitionists, but yes, he did.
Okay. So tell us, and I want to hear about some of the more key women here. Lucy Stone, we haven't talked about her. Who was she?
Lucy Stone graduated from Oberlin College in 1847 and immediately began lecturing both in support of women's rights and against slavery. And she became perhaps the most popular lecturer during the 1840s and 1850s, both for women's rights and against slavery. She also was a key organizer of the first National Women's Rights Convention, which was held, as you mentioned earlier, right here in Worcester in 1850.
Okay, so tell us more about that, because I think many people may have a passing knowledge of Seneca Falls at least, but I don't think the Worcester Convention of 1850 really comes up in folks' mind. What happened there?
So the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 was certainly a very important convention. It was a local convention. It was women in upstate New York. Lucy Stone and her allies had this brilliant idea that they should organize a national convention. And about 1,000 women from 11 different states congregated in Worcester to have a whole convention dedicated to women's rights. And not only did they have this convention, but then they set up a system of annual conventions. They also established committees to carry out all sorts of organizing and advocacy between conventions. It really was the start of the organized movement.
I see. So it provided the momentum for that.
Okay.
Correct. So 1850s, though, I mean, we're headed straight towards a civil war that obviously disrupted these efforts dramatically.
The Civil War was a great interrupter. What happened during the Civil War was Lucy Stone, along with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, turned their attention to supporting the war effort, to supporting the effort to eradicate slavery from the nation. And then they resumed with the women's rights movement really right after the Civil War ended in 1865.
But that produced a schism between these women.
That produced an enormous schism, putting Lucy Stone on the one side and Anthony and Stanton on the other side. And the schism was over the 15th Amendment, which, of course, granted the right to vote to black men but left women out. Those three women had hoped that instead Congress would pass an amendment that would provide universal franchise and would enfranchise both black men and black and white women.
So Stone nevertheless supported the 15th Amendment, right?
Correct. Stone said it was terrible that women were left out, but it's wonderful that somebody is getting the vote, and therefore I support the 15th Amendment and will continue to dedicate my efforts now to enfranchising women.
And Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony did not support it.
Correct.
This is a side of them that I haven't heard about all that much. I mean, you write about that Stone found Anthony's and Stanton's racist commentary during the debate over the amendment unpardonable.
It's a part of Anthony and Stanton's history that certainly scholars know well, but is almost absent from popular culture, from popular knowledge of them. They opposed the 15th Amendment in horrifyingly racist terms.
Sorry, I mean, it just takes my breath away a little bit because we think of them as these champions of women's rights, and I guess in our minds it just bleeds into civil rights as a whole.
Right. And of course, I mean, later on, there was a reconciliation between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass, for example. I mean, they were great heroines of American history in many ways. But there was this, you know, horrible, unpardonable racism after the Civil War over the 15th Amendment for various reasons. And this gets into the politics of writing history.
Yeah.
That story has not been well known.
Interesting. Okay. Now, what about African American women in this movement? Because obviously they suffered the double burden of both racism and slavery and, being women, disenfranchised women as well.
Correct. When the schism occurred after the Civil War, the Lucy Stone Wing, which was based here in Boston, welcomed black women into the movement. The Anthony Stanton Wing, which was based in New York, did not. Later in 1890, when the two groups were reconciled, the joint movement, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, was, for a variety of reasons, primarily, although not entirely, a white movement.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, can you tell us briefly about one or two of those reasons? Because I do want to get into how Massachusetts shouldn't actually pat itself on the back too much.
Absolutely. So. I mean, the brief answer is that the women's suffrage movement, like any movement, does not exist independently from all the social currents swirling around society around it. And in 1890, when the joint movement was formed, it was the height of Jim Crow. These women knew that they were going to have to ultimately get Southern support for what became the 19th Amendment. Many of them, of course, were somewhat racist or largely racist anyway, and they made a compromise with the devil, so to speak, to not worry about whether or not black women would be enfranchised. I mean, the amendment would enfranchise all women, but they tacitly agreed they would turn a blind eye to that Southern attempts to restrict voting by black women as well as by black men.
Okay. Now, I mean, we've been talking about Massachusetts women as key to the suffragette movement, but you do write that Massachusetts as a state actually lagged behind other states significantly in giving suffrage to women.
That's correct. I mean, Massachusetts had a faction of conservative blue bloods as well as others who were very opposed to changing the status quo. And so, ironically, the home of Lucy Stone and this abolitionist movement became really a leading center of the movement against suffrage.
Barbara Berenson is a senior attorney at the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and author of a number of books, including her latest, Massachusetts in the Woman Suffrage Movement. Now, the story of another revolutionary Massachusetts woman. Deborah Sampson was born in 1760 near Plymouth. Unusually for a woman of her time, in 1782, Sampson took up arms against the British during the Revolutionary War. She dressed as a man named Robert Shurtleff and joined the 4th Massachusetts Regiment. Sampson fought for almost 2 years, enduring cannon fire, leading raids, and even extracting a pistol ball herself after being shot in the thigh. Sampson was eventually discovered and given honorable discharge in October of 1783. She married, had kids, and then she petitioned for the pension she'd earned with her military service. Historian Michael Bronski says Deborah Sampson ran into problems.
And they said, no, you're a girl. But to further her public relations campaign, essentially, she toured around New England. The first half of her show, her act, was that she talked about how she fought in the Revolution. She really doesn't know why, because she was a woman and she loves her children and she loves her husband. But nevertheless, she dressed as a man for 3.5 years. The second act, she'd come out dressed as a man and do like an hour-long, very difficult military drill with arms and exercises and marching back and forth. So, you know, as far back as the late 1780s, we have this notion of America being pretty free with gender roles.
Sampson's story is just one of the early examples of gender nonconformity that appears in Bronski's book, A Queer History of the United States. We spoke with him in 2011, and Bronski told us that New England was an early epicenter of queer history. And he added that queer history is a complicated concept itself, one with two seemingly paradoxical axioms.
There are two things to keep in mind. The first thing to keep in mind is that LGBT people are integral to every single aspect of American society from before Columbus got here up until the present. And to ignore this is a terrible thing, and we need to bring these people to the forefront. The second most important thing to keep in mind is that queer history doesn't exist. What we're looking at here is American history. These are absolutely necessary and great transitional moments to not claim it as being American history. Shortchanges these people, shortchanges the LGBT community, and also shortchanges the imagination of all Americans to accept the fact that we come from, whether we love it or hate it or whatever, a country that is so complex, so ever-evolving, so complicated in its history, this wonderful collection of people, all of whom make up America.
You know, as I was reading your book, it occurred to me it's very much like wearing a set of polarizing lenses on your sunglasses. You're looking at the same picture, the same image. Everyone is all there, but you just rotate the lenses 90 degrees and suddenly a whole new dimension, you know, that you hadn't seen before, and the way that it's all connected emerges. That's kind of the sense that I got from your book. I want to talk a little bit regarding where we find ourselves today. In order to do that, I wanted to raise something that you identified in your book, and that is the transcendentalists and sort of the mid-19th century. We have Walt Whitman, you know, writing overtly sexual themes in right. Leaves of Grass. We also have Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau writing about their quote-unquote sympathies for male friends. Now, you really highlight this word sympathy in particular. Why is that?
It's a word we actually have a very specific meaning for today that actually in the 18th and 19th century was used very differently. And sympathy meant closer to what we now call empathy. When you had sympathy, it meant that you could understand another human. You could understand your fellow man, by which they generally meant man. What's interesting about it then, because there are such huge inequalities between the sexes, it's hard for men and women to have sympathy for one another since they're essentially viewed as different species in some way. So the notion of sympathy works best as a concept between men and between women. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I really chart how we see this affection, affiliation, often in the case of Walt Whitman, certainly overt sexual desire. But we see it in the journals of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who clearly falls in love with a man in his Harvard class named Martin Gay, whom he has sympathy for.
And he writes pretty intensely about his attraction to him.
Yes, as does a passage I quote from Henry David Thoreau, where he's actually hiding in a willow tree watching naked boys bathe. He doesn't use the word sympathy, but he actually is clearly fascinated by them and then has a meditation on white skin, red skin, black skin, and brown skin, and how this evolves into a notion of sort of social justice for all men. We also see it in the writings of Margaret Fuller as well. I would argue that these people are saying, we've come from this Puritan society. We reject this completely. Mm-hmm. We want to fulfill the promise of America. We want to have social justice for everybody. And these people who have this great sympathy, really, they work in the abolition movement. They work in suffrage. They begin working in any number of different reform movements, education. Samuel Grinley Howe starts the Perkins School for the Blind. You know, these people, and this is pretty much a New England, Boston phenomenon,
right,
really start the very notion of what we consider equality within America.
Well, the reason why I ask is there's no evidence, to me at least, in my readings of Emerson and Thoreau, that, you know, they were identifying overtly or consciously with whatever homosexuality meant at that time. No evidence of that
whatsoever.
No evidence
at all. And to be fair, homosexuality, the word is not invented until 1869. So there is no concept of, I'm feeling this, I must be a homosexual.
Well, that's exactly the point, right? Yeah. There were many times in American history where there's a greater degree of fluidity, of forgiveness even, or just a wider sense as to the spectrum of human sympathies, right, emotions, desires.
Possibilities.
Then we may even have today. Because any writer today who would put, you know, in modern terms, those same sensibilities and desires would immediately be identified, whether he or she wanted to or not, as someone writing from an LGBT perspective.
Completely. And we see this all the time. We see it certainly when the journals and letters of John Cheever were published. People said, oh my God, John Cheever's a homosexual. And John Cheever was happily, or he was drunk most of the time, but was actually, you know, married, had children, had some affairs with men, which he was tortured over. But certainly there's no way that John Cheever is a homosexual in the way that we mean that.
Right.
You know, another reason why I think using the word queer is useful for the book title, because the word queer really seemed to fit into the notion of sort of queering, and not in the more current sense, but in the older sense of making it different.
Mm-hmm.
Not only adding LGBT people, but adding all kinds of new information that would make us rethink the real complexity and the real kaleidoscope that American history has actually been.
Because I guess what I'm wondering is, in the many political advancements and civil rights advancements that have been made in the past many hundred years regarding the LGBT community, have we ironically at the same time reached a point where, because identity is so much part of modern day queer issues, that it's actually reduced our understanding of the spectrum of possibilities of human desires for everybody else?
Right, completely. And I think this is true of many identities and many movements. Certainly, I have women students who will not ever say that they were feminists. They hate the word feminist. If you give them a checklist of what they believed in, it would be 100% what Gloria Steinem would articulate as feminism.
So we are in a place of more limited imagination today?
I believe so. I believe two things. I believe that we're in a place of limited imaginations, and we're in a place of people having, for very good reasons, constructed a language to identify people, to express who they are. And it's a language that was, over time, very liberatory, and I believe in some ways has become more limiting in how people will describe themselves and how they will actually discuss or think about their own possibilities.
Hmm. Now, I don't want anyone to think that, you know, I'm being a Pollyanna here and saying, oh, it was so great back then
right.
In comparison to now, or that it, you know, now is even perfect in and of itself, because obviously when it comes to LGBT issues and, quite frankly, homophobia of any kind, that it's still a huge problem in American society. And that actually leads me, I mean, since we started talking about queer history in the United States and how it has an early epicenter here in New England, it also has a modern-day epicenter in terms of gay marriage, you know, Massachusetts
completely.
Being
yes.
the first state
the
that
first
legalized
state, yes.
same-sex marriage. But Michael Bronski, interestingly, you say that you're of two minds about gay marriage.
I'm of far more than two minds about it. Without any doubt or hesitation, if we have marriage, which we do and we will for a very long time, I don't see any way we aren't going to have it, we should have same-sex marriage. It is simply legal equality. I do think there is a way in which marriage historically and traditionally has been a way to organize society the ways in which marriage is fully described by its proponents and people who are not in favor of it as being a way to limit the possibilities of human behavior. One of the themes in the book is that I talk about that there's this real tension in American society. And the tension is the fight for equality under the law, which is extraordinarily important and really necessary because the law has been so unequally applied for hundreds of years. The other impulse, and I think this is in many ways a very American impulse, is actually one of personal freedom. Mm-hmm. So if, in fact, the book has non-LGBT heroes, one of them is Victoria Woodhull, who is the first woman to run for president in 1862, who actually announces that she is a free lover and can choose any man she wants for as long as she wants or as short as she wants, and that is her constitutional right of freedom of love and affection. And I think that so many times in the history of the LGBT movement, lesbians and gay men, particularly looking at the 50s, have simply fought to keep the state out of their bedroom. Mm-hmm. You know, now marriage actually puts the state into your bedroom, and that's fine. That's equality under the law. But I just want to, for us to have a discussion that there is actually a tension here between these two different impulses. And if people want to get married, they certainly shouldn't. That would be wonderful for them. And if people don't want to, they should not get married and take Victoria Woodhull's advice and take lovers for as short or long a time as they choose. But these are two different, very American struggles.
Michael Bronski is the author of A Queer History of the United States. He's now a professor at Harvard University. We spoke with him back in 2011. We'll be back with more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're listening back to our favorite conversations about those who were not free, even as America declared its independence on this day in 1776. So we want to end this hour where we started, with those immortal words written by Thomas Jefferson with quill and ink into the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson's words are the epitome of the Enlightenment's view of the true meaning of liberty, that liberty is intrinsic to the human experience and is as precious as life itself. But of course, Thomas Jefferson was also a slave owner. He was an active participant in a system that for centuries denied liberty to his fellow Americans. So in 2016, we talked about that fundamental conflict with two of the nation's preeminent Jefferson scholars. Annette Gordon Reed is a Harvard professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of the definitive history of Sally Hemings and her family. Hemings is the enslaved woman with whom Jefferson had a long-term relationship. Peter Onuf is professor emeritus at the University of Virginia, which Jefferson founded, and they co-authored the book Most Blessed of Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. And in the book they write, quote, "It is impossible to understand the country the United States has become without grappling with Jefferson and his legacy." So I began by asking them, with Jefferson as perhaps the most written about founding father, what of his legacy was left to explore?
We think that the false distinction between Jefferson's public life and the things he said, as in the Declaration of Independence, and his private life, that's a false distinction. We're trying to put Jefferson back together again to show how his ideas grow out of his life experiences.
And we're also trying to move the discussion beyond fixating on hypocrisy, which is a usual thing you do now. It's a sort of a shutdown word that keeps people from actually thinking about Jefferson, I think, we think, in a productive kind of way. Yeah. And so we wanted to move the ball a little bit further down the field than has been stuck for the past couple of decades.
Well, so I want to come back to this notion about how we see him today in just a moment. But let's first of all uncover or explore a little bit of what you write in the book. I mean, the subtitle of the book is Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. The title, though, itself, Most Blessed of Patriarchs, that comes from a letter that Jefferson himself wrote in, what, 1793?
Right. Yes.
Doesn't it seem a little strange to you that the great icon of democracy would call himself
a patriarch?
A patriarch, yeah. We thought that was an opening to take a closer look at Jefferson. Why would he say that in the midst of a career devoted to the Republican experiment that's going to change the world? And he seems to be glorying in the fact that he is the lord of his domain. That seems like a big disconnect.
Okay, so when he used the word patriarch in his mind, what form of patriarchy was he thinking about? Because this was vis-a-vis, well, he was writing about returning to Monticello, right? Mm-hmm.
He is in control of 5,000 acres, a couple of hundred enslaved people, a white family. As the male, he is the head of the family. And he's thinking about the privileges that he has, but he also is thinking about responsibilities that he has to people. So it's the whole ball of wax there. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very large sense of, and I think I would have to say, a very realistic sense of the power relations that existed between him and other people.
You're probably not old enough to remember when men were supposed to dominate, when patriarchy was thought to be natural.
Some would say the nature era has not come to an end yet.
Well, nature is a key word for Jefferson. And what we know is a socially constructed relationship, the way families are organized and have been organized, we see it changing in our own lifetime. So it's demystified. It's no longer natural. But in Jefferson's day, the idea of the father's domination over his family is a given.
Well, the problem, the sense of hypocrisy, comes out of our own questions. And they're legitimate questions, but it's more about us than it really is about the way he is seeing the world.
So I guess this brings forward the question I was going to come to a little bit later, because we see it as hypocrisy now, or some people see it. Another word may be contradiction. Yeah. But was he a contradiction even in his own time? Because many people would point to George Washington, who in his will emancipated his slaves.
He had to be dead first, of course, you understand.
But Jefferson did not do that for his own slaves, except for the children he had with Sally Hemings.
Yes, and some of their relatives. Well, Washington is an interesting case. When he died and provided for the emancipation of slaves upon Martha's death, there were some people who thought that that was sort of a cop-out. He had enormous political capital, and he spent none of it on the issue of slavery while he was alive.
Jefferson did know that slavery was unjust, and he had a solution. It's not a solution that we recognize as legitimate. It was never going to happen, but it was, we need to emancipate the enslaved people, and that has to be a collective decision of the slave-owning class, that is, white Virginians. It's their country, he thinks. And that decision would be emancipate and expatriate. This, the unfriendly word for this, is deportation, or we might even think of things like genocide. It's horrible. But for Jefferson, it's
doing
justice.
Well, I wouldn't say genocide. Black people can live without white people.
yeah, exactly right. Yeah. But the idea is that he says in his plan for emancipation, we will send them someplace. It would turn out maybe Africa. And we would, that is the white people, the people who had votes, the citizens, the legislators of Virginia, would declare them a free and independent people.
You know, Peter's exactly right. If you emancipated blacks without expatriation, there would be conflict. And there would, you know, they couldn't live together in peace. And eventually there would be a race war.
Yeah.
That solution wasn't going to take place tomorrow or even the next day or the next year or the next, maybe it would be the next century. It would be a future generation that would take on this task. And why would they do it? And this is key, I think, to the empire of the imagination. It's because of his vision of progress and improvement. They would be more enlightened. In other words, he's predicting that there will be a change of consciousness that will lead Virginian slave owners to sacrifice this valuable property and do the right thing.
And it's tough for us because we don't have that sense of progress. Yeah. I think we're a much more cynical age. So when you hear him say that, you say, oh, he can't possibly believe that.
We know us.
But I'm curious, though, because what I'm still quite not 100% certain of, and I wonder if you can explain it to me a little more, did Jefferson rest easy with the contradiction that he was experiencing? I mean, like, as you say, he wanted to see progress.
Easier than we think he should. And that's where we get back to patriarchy. And as Annette says, his conception of himself as a good slave owner, he has a kind of a stewardship responsibility. There's an intimacy here. There's a sense of connection that's really important in his domestic world.
Mm-hmm. And we reject this, but we're thinking, but again, it's not just about what we think about it. It's you thinking about how he's viewing the world. He does think of this as, these are my responsibilities. And we kind of go, when you hear that. But that's what was there.
Right. You know, it's really interesting because there's a chapter in the book which I would have never thought would be included in a new investigation or exploration of Jefferson. And you write about Jefferson and music.
Yeah.
Can you tell us why this was so important?
Because this was, he described it as the favorite passion of his soul. And this was something that was critical to his sense of self. It's something that brought him joy. It was something that we suggest sort of goes to his system of desire for order and control. It was everywhere to him. He sang all the time, apparently, and had mockingbirds who sang, and his children with Sally, all the sons played the violin, his daughters played the harpsichord. So there's no way, we didn't think we could talk about the character of the man without bringing this particular aspect of him, which, as you say, isn't talked about very much, mm-hmm. to the fore, because it's always there for him.
To put it bluntly, it's not jazz that he's in favor of. Maybe folk music, because that's his people and it resonates for him. But making music together is, in a way, epitomizes his idea of the good conversations in society that make for harmony and that make for order, as Annette says. It's a model of republican government. We should be making beautiful music together.
And he uses that as a metaphor when he's talking about life in lots of different ways. So it's the actual physical playing of music. When he's in France, he loves being there with the type of music that he can hear that he can't hear in the United States. But as Peter says, he extrapolates from that to sort of everyday life and his vision of government and his vision of the way a community comes together.
I understand that he was even so enraptured with music that he was concerned about the sound of the oral delivery of the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, yeah. No, that is our music, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he scripted it. Or what are music? People write music, they don't script things.
Yeah, we get what you mean.
Well, so let's talk a little bit. I mean, speaking of the Declaration, it's from the mind, the imagination of this man that the Declaration of Independence springs forth, you know, like the founding document of the nation. So tell us a little bit more about sort of what you found vis-a-vis the other sort of hidden recesses of his imagination that help us understand him today.
He's thinking about religion. He's thinking about a sort of crafting, as he does, a civic, you know, civil religion for the United States of America, taking the Bible and cutting it up, removing miracles and sort of leaving a document that he thinks will spark the emotions and the imaginations of people to give them a sort of a religion that will be suitable to a Republican government. So he's thinking about all aspects of American life.
Now, what would be your response to someone today? And there are many people who still would come to you and say, okay, most blessed of patriarchs, take your point, Jefferson, a man of his time, in his time, but I still see him as a hypocrite. Because, I mean, even the things that we've been talking about, he was maybe a little too easy, given the difference between American reality and what he wanted. Well, I mean, how do you argue against that?
You might ask a different question, and that is, how would somebody ever imagine a political system, a world based on the principle of equality? You have to lift yourself beyond your own circumstances. And this is what we call him to account for, because he could see something. He could imagine that nature enjoined and nature's God enjoined us to form governments based on affection, attachment, consent. And that vision, you say, well, it's impossible because he lived in the midst of slaves and it's not an equal society. But ask the question of how could he transcend his times? We hate him for what we love him for. That is, that he could say these things, and we say, you can't say these things. You didn't live them.
Well, you write in, you point out that he wrote in Notes on Virginia, the whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, with that in mind, it was at the University of Virginia, the college and university that he founded, I mean, he wanted on his headstone, father of the University of Virginia, where there was a movement to remove or rethink whether or not a statue of Jefferson should be on the campus?
To me, that's an easier question. People often ask me about that. It depends on the person. I mean, you can't have the University of Virginia without Jefferson. So it would be sort of, bizarre if people thought that they could just sort of, you know, disappear him from that particular campus.
That on American campuses, there is this push now to rethink whether or not that these particular founding fathers should have such places of honor and respect on campuses.
No, we need to understand and engage our own history. That's all we're saying. And you can't have that history without the founders. Now, we don't worship the founders, but we know they're there. And we have to engage with them. You got this country, and it offers you opportunities to do things, to craft your own vision, to make things different. and give them their credit, and especially Jefferson. They saw those possibilities. They thought they were on the cusp of a new world that they could shape. And it's that exhilaration, that sense of possibility that we want to recapture, not the sordid realities of the fact that they drank so much and whipped slaves and whipped each other. And it was, I mean, it's a nasty period. But all that nastiness and all that sordidness, they could see beyond it. And can we see beyond what we have now? I mean, that's the rhetorical question I'd ask.
Their reality belongs to us. We can't walk away from that any more than you can walk away from the country.
Annette Gordon-Reed and Peter Onuf co-authored Most Blessed of Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. We spoke with them in 2016. Well, that's it for this special hour remembering those who were not free, even as America declared its independence. And while our shared history is complex, the words and the power of the Declaration of Independence still inspire and guide me as an American today, particularly its last words, where, even if imperfectly, Thomas Jefferson reminds us that we're all in this together. And for the support of this declaration, he writes, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.